Hi, I'm Shannon, the podcast producer here at C-SPAN. Did you know that Ronald Reagan was the first president to address both houses of parliament in 1982? Well, this week on the Lectures in History podcast, Robert Rowland, University of Kansas political communications professor, discusses Ronald Reagan's 1982 address and provides some insights. Class starts right after this.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach. So no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Today we're talking about Ronald Reagan's speech on June 8th of 1982 in the Palace of Westminster in the Royal Gallery. It was quite a dramatic scene. Let's watch just a few seconds of it.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President Reagan.
You see the beefeaters behind him, the wigged lord, you see the assembled people. Doesn't look much like the State of the Union in the United States. It is now remembered as one of the most important presidential speeches of at least the 20th and 21st century. In the speech, Reagan seemed to predict that the Soviet Union would end up, and he's quoting, paraphrasing Trotsky here, on the ash heap of history. He said that the Cold War was fundamentally a battle of ideas and that we were at a turning point and that the West and democratic ideas would win. Almost no one believed he was right at the time. But within a decade, the Soviet Union did in fact end up on the ash heap of history. And many of the nations that had formerly been allied with the Soviet Union in the Warsaw Pact, nations like Poland and what became the Czech Republic, they became democracies, applied and were admitted to the European Union, and as quickly as they could, they joined NATO because they had experienced Soviet tyranny. And the arms control agreements that Reagan mentioned briefly in Westminster, they in fact were negotiated. The two most important arms control agreements in the United States and the Soviet Union, then Russia's history. A quarter century later, the speech was celebrated at the National Endowment for Democracy, an organization that was created in part because of the speech. Because of Reagan's predictions had become so true. That's why the speech is now considered to be among Reagan's most significant speeches. According to one of Reagan's closest advisors, Edwin Meese, the speech was especially important because it functioned as the kickoff for activities in support of winning the Cold War. When Reagan was famously asked, what is his strategy for the Cold War? He answered that the only possible strategy was we win and they lose. And what he meant by that was that the only possible strategy was that democracies would win, and actually, in the long term, he hoped that Russia would win as well by becoming a democratic nation, something that happened for a brief period of time. One of the most insightful observers of Reagan's rhetoric, Lou Cannon, who wrote for the Washington Post, concluded that the Westminster speech stands the test of time as the most farsighted and encompassing of Reagan's anti-communist messages. a judgment supported by a recent biographer, John Patrick Diggins, who labeled it as one of the president's two most famous speeches. But now we have the beginning of a puzzle, because the speech was not well received at the time. Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, called it a triumph immediately after the speech. She was virtually alone in making that judgment. The response to the speech in Great Britain was quite negative. Stephen Ratner, writing in the New York Times, cited a conservative columnist for the Daily Mail, Andrew Alexander, who attacked Reagan's oversimplified view of the world. A former British ambassador to Washington, Peter Jay, labeled the speech as extremely hard-line and said he seemed almost to be declaring non-military war on the Soviet Union. He said if he does mean it, it's very frightening. One of the most brutal reactions came from Nancy Banks Smith in the Guardian newspaper, who labeled the speech as unmemorable and then said about it that it was like Lincoln at Gettysburg in only one way. It fulfilled Lincoln's comment, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here," a prediction that turned out to be quite wrong. She even criticized Reagan's delivery, calling him an average sort of performer. An editorial in The Guardian, he listened to the incredibly negative language and the arrogance of the language. They talked about Reagan's homespun amiability and said the president is a senior citizen who, when crisis breaks, is left to sleep. The editorial concluded that very little can be built on the president's words, which reflects his benign, blank helplessness. It is revealing that some of the most positive comments in the British press about the speech referenced the president's use of a teleprompter, which they'd never seen before. In their view, it was a failed speech in style and substance, and the only thing that mattered was that Reagan used the magic of the teleprompter. The press reaction in the United States was, I think we could say, tepid, not quite lukewarm. Where many of the commentators argued that Reagan's claim that about the precarious condition of the Soviet Empire was wishful thinking. Edmund Morris, later a biographer of Reagan, said it came across as a strained attempt at grand rhetoric. Another dominant reaction in the American press was the speech had sounded good, but it just wasn't very specific. While praising Reagan's defense of democracy, for example, the New York Times said that Reagan characteristically failed to point the way from here to there or to give the Russians a plausible range of policy choices. Jim Anderson of UPI said the speech had few specific examples of the kind of project that Reagan had in mind. The New York Times, in the same editorial I referenced a moment ago, referenced Reagan's claim that democracy is not a fragile flower. And the Times concluded sarcastically about that, "Flower power can work, but where's his spade?" Others thought that the speech just didn't reflect American-Soviet policy, that the administration seemed, in the words of one commentator, have no Soviet policy. Peter Schweitzer, who later wrote about the Star Wars program, noted that Reagan was ridiculed by scholars who believed he was fooling himself about the weaknesses of communism. Now we have a couple puzzles. This is a speech that is remembered as one of the most important presidential foreign policy speeches of the 20th and 21st century, in the same category as FDR's Four Freedoms speech. At the time, people thought it was largely ineffective and a failure. What makes it resonate so much better in the long term? And how did Reagan see, when others did not, the fundamental weaknesses in the Soviet Union? Those are the puzzles that we have to confront. To begin to answer those puzzles, we need to start by thinking about the audiences to whom Reagan was speaking. And we've seen a little bit of the audience there in the Royal Gallery. So he certainly is speaking to Parliament and other assembled people in Great Britain. But more broadly, Reagan was speaking to the United States, to our allies in Western Europe, and our allies in Asia, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan, Japan, South Korea. And he is asking them to continue to support his Soviet policy. He's on a trip to Europe where he's trying to build support. And his conclusion is that optimism is in order because day by day, democracy is proving itself to be a not at all fragile, fragile flower. His goal was to preserve freedom as well as peace. And he predicted, it may not be easy to see, but I believe we live now at a turning point, a conclusion that almost everyone thought was wrong, but that was totally right. But Reagan also spoke to another audience. Reagan was speaking indirectly to the Soviets because he knew that they were listening. One message he had for the Soviets is he's telling them that he recognizes, and they in their hearts know, that the Soviet system simply doesn't work. He says, we are witnessing today a great revolutionary crisis, a crisis where the demands of the economic order are conflicting directly with those of the political order. And he concluded, it is the Soviet Union that runs against the tide of history. Almost no one thought that was true then, but we now know that it was entirely true from the analysis of Soviet economic data after the end of the Soviet Union. But he had a second message, and he was sending this message with the arms buildup. He had believed the United States had fallen behind, and he was using an arms buildup not to prepare for war, but to prepare for peace. The arms buildup was primarily rhetorical, in a sense, that he was sending a message. Reagan said in the speech, our military strength is a prerequisite to peace, but let it be clear we maintain this strength in the hope it never will be used. He supported an arms buildup that ultimately led to the two most important arms reduction treaties ever negotiated, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement and the START Agreement. Unfortunately, only the START agreement remains in effect because Putin pulled Russia out of the INF agreement. One reason that we can understand why Reagan's message didn't work very well in the short term is to focus on the incredible barriers that he faced in getting this message across. So I want to talk about attitudes in Europe and, to a lesser extent, Japan, South Korea, Asian allies of the United States, the United States, and then the barriers it faced in sending the message to the Soviet Union. The first barrier was fear of nuclear war. Over the course of the spring of 1982, it became very clear that there was major opposition to Reagan's arms buildup in Western Europe. Writing in Business Week, Saul Sanders noted authorities in Germany worried about, I'm quoting, vast outpourings of youth and radicals who accused the U.S. of seeking world domination. According to The Guardian, the problems are related to endemic policy disagreement in which the U.S. is on the opposite side from Europe on almost every important topic. Right before the speech, in the days before, 100,000 demonstrators jammed Hyde Park protesting American defense policy. A member of Reagan's National Security Council staff and a major Soviet scholar, Richard Pipes, cogently explained the audience problem that Reagan faced in Europe as the English elite regard Reagan as a dangerous simpleton. The fear of nuclear war was a major problem for Reagan in the United States as well. Michael Barone noted in the Washington Post that a great many Americans and Europeans believe that Reagan is significantly more likely than his predecessors to get us into a nuclear war. A Washington Post poll found that by a 3-to-1 margin, American people supported a nuclear freeze. That would have not reduced nuclear weapons, but would have frozen them where they were. And it might sound like a good idea, but Reagan's whole approach was to build up to create leverage for real arms reductions. So Reagan faced a really big problem in the United States. A Washington Post ABC poll, the same poll found that a significant portion of the American public has become increasingly anxious over the prospect of a nuclear war, frightened over the buildup of the U.S. arsenal, and frustrated by the lack of serious negotiation between the two superpowers. So an awful lot of people in the West, also South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, they're afraid. And that's true in America, too. There's a second barrier he faced, which is the perception that many people had that he was a mouthpiece, that he had just been a grade B movie actor in Hollywood, that he was simply not up to the job. A British commentator, Roy Hattersley, labeled Reagan a man of naive ideas and simple opinions, which he holds with the certainty of a Midwestern preacher. Another British commentator labeled Reagan and Thatcher as the Lone Ranger and the Iron Lady. A columnist in the Sunday Mirror referred to him as old Hopalong and said he needed to do some fast fence mending. They're talking about the President of the United States in this incredibly dismissive way. And an awful lot of people at home in the United States thought Reagan was just a mere mouthpiece. Frankly, at this point, I would have thought that too. He also faced a problem of low popularity at home. He began 1982 with less public support than President Carter at a similar stage in his presidency. President Carter was not very good at molding public support. To have less than Carter had had, that was not good. A poll in April of 1982 found that 52% of the American people were opposed to Reagan running for a second term. New York Times quoted a Reagan advisor, a senior advisor, who said, "There's no question the guy's in deep trouble." Finally, Reagan faced the barrier that the message was complicated. Reagan was saying that we had to build up in order to cut back our forces. That was a complicated message. He was also saying that he was for real arms reductions while labeling the Soviet Union a failed tyranny. It was a complicated message that people didn't understand. And it was especially complicated for the Soviets, who understandably reacted, "The guy's insulting us constantly. He said our system doesn't work, and we're supposed to believe he really wants arms reductions." They found that very hard to believe. Now we need to talk about the answer to the puzzles I've laid out. Most rhetoric in American politics, and general probably politics around the world, is tactical. It responds to issues of the moment. Sometimes it's stylistically well presented, and it doesn't make much difference in the long run. Think about all the speeches of President Bill Clinton that were very well received. He was thought of as incredibly effective, and then try to remember one of those speeches that resonates since his presidency. I don't think you can find one. But rhetoric sometimes has more import. And when rhetoric has more import, it's about not the style, but about the substance. It's about the messages. And it's especially about messages that lay out ideological visions, worldviews, definitions of the world, or that give us a narrative about that world, about what is America's place in the world, and where are we going, where have we been, and how are we going to get to that better future. And this rhetoric also tends to give us values, things that we believe in. Think about Barack Obama talking about the audacity of hope. The most effective political leaders, both Roosevelt's, Reagan, Obama, King more than anyone else in the 20th century, and Lincoln more than anyone else in American history, have given us ideological arguments, narratives that reenacted those ideological arguments, and sets of values that moved the nation forward. In fact, there is a strong argument that I've made in my academic writing that dominance in American politics from FDR through Reagan to Obama, at least, could be charted based on the party that had a better conception that resonated with the American people of the American dream. This rhetoric has a broader influence because it's more than a stylistic statement about a particular point. It gives us a way of understanding the world. Think about Ronald Reagan's statement in the first inaugural address that in this present crisis, government is not the solution, government is the problem. That attitude that we needed less government to move the nation forward dominated the nation for a quarter of a century. And then think in contrast about Barack Obama, who said that with just a slight shift in our priorities, we could help all those who needed help. Those two worldviews dominated American politics before the age of Trump. At Westminster, what Reagan gave us was a coherent ideological definition of the world that said democracy works and authoritarian systems don't. He gave us a narrative of moving toward greater freedom, and he embraced a set of values that was consistent with the narrative and consistent with the ideology. And I want to begin by talking about the ideological worldview, which really is, if you had to boil it down to a sentence, it would be that democracy works and Soviet authoritarianism, totalitarianism doesn't. After speaking of the danger of nuclear war, Reagan said, "At the same time there's a threat posed to human freedom by the enormous power of the modern state, history teaches the dangers of government that overreaches, political control taking precedence over free economic growth, secret police, mindless bureaucracy, all combining to stifle individual excellence and personal freedom." He then contrasted those horrors with democracy. And he admitted here that there was disagreement on the West on how big government should be, how large the social welfare system. He said, "Now I'm aware that among us here and throughout Europe, there is legitimate disagreement over the extent to which the public sector should play a role in the nation's economy and life. But on one point, all of us are united: our abhorrence of dictatorship in all its forms, but most particularly totalitarianism and the terrible inhumanities it has caused in our time, the Great Purge, Auschwitz and Dachau, the Gulag in Cambodia." He then added that democracies were also committed not just to freedom and protecting their own people, but to peace. He said it was the democracies who refused to use the threat of their nuclear monopoly in the 40s and early 50s for territorial or empirical gain. And he said, had that nuclear monopoly been in the hands of the communist world, the map of Europe, indeed the world, would look very different today. Now, I've given you the main arguments he made, but I want to give you more of the flavor of how Reagan said it.
In an ironic sense, Karl Marx was right. We are witnessing today a great revolutionary crisis, a crisis where the demands of the economic order are conflicting directly with those of the political order. But the crisis is happening not in the free, non-Marxist West, but in the home of Marxist Leninism, the Soviet Union. It is the Soviet Union that runs against the tide of history by denying human freedom and human dignity to its citizens. It also is in deep economic difficulty. The rate of growth in the national product has been steadily declining since the 50s and is less than half of what it was then. The dimensions of this failure are astounding. A country which employs one-fifth of its population in agriculture is unable to feed its own people. Were it not for the private sector, the tiny private sector tolerated in Soviet agriculture, the country might be on the brink of famine.
These private plots occupy a bare 3% of the arable land, but account for nearly one quarter of Soviet farm output and nearly one third of meat products and vegetables. Over-centralized, with little or no incentives, year after year, the Soviet system pours its best resource into the making of instruments of destruction. The constant shrinkage of economic growth combined with the growth of military production is putting a heavy strain on the Soviet people. What we see here is a political structure that no longer corresponds to its economic base, a society where productive forces are hampered by political ones. The decay of the Soviet experiment should come as no surprise to us. Wherever the comparisons have been made between free and closed societies, West Germany and East Germany, Austria and Czechoslovakia, Malaysia and Vietnam, it is the democratic countries that are prosperous and responsive to the needs of their people. And one of the simple but overwhelming facts of our time is this: of all the millions of refugees we've seen in the modern world, their flight is always away from, not toward, the communist world. Today, on the NATO line, our military forces face east to prevent a possible invasion. On the other side of the line, the Soviet forces also face east to prevent their people from leaving. The hard...
I want you to remember that line. Today, on the NATO line, our military forces face east to prevent a possible invasion. On the other side of the line, the Soviet forces also face east to prevent their people from leaving. I'll tell you in a minute why that line is so important and what it tells us about President Reagan. At this point, Reagan's ideological vision is clear. Democracies protect rights, keep the peace, and produce economic growth. The Soviet system fails on all three grounds. Therefore, he said, what we have to consider here today, while time remains, is the permanent prevention of war and the establishment of conditions of freedom and democracy as rapidly as possible in all countries. At the time, it seemed that Reagan, people rejected it out of hand. But what it really was like the little boy pointing out that the emperor had no clothes. And that, as I'll explain in a minute, is why it resonated so well. At this point, the rationale behind Reagan's Soviet policies is clear. He called out the Soviet Union as a failed system to provide rhetorical support for those who suffered under Soviet rule. He also wanted to make it clear to the Soviet Union that the United States and the West could not be bullied. He supported a buildup in which he said the West must, for its own protection, be an unwilling participant. At first, you might think that makes no sense. Why would we have to be an unwilling participant? But because he wanted to create the preconditions for real arms reductions by sending the message to the Soviet Union that their economies simply couldn't keep up with what the United States. And that's why he supported those real arms control agreements, the zero option that led to the INF Treaty, and his proposal, he says, for a one-third reduction in strategic ballistic missile warheads. That was the START Treaty, and it eventually was more than a two-thirds reduction. Why was Reagan so confident that we were at what he called a turning point? He was confident not because of guns and bullets, but because of ideas. He says early in the speech, optimism comes less easily today, not because democracy is less vigorous, but because democracy's enemies have refined their instruments of oppression. Yet optimism is in order because day by day, democracy is proving itself to be a not at all fragile flower. From Stettin on the Baltic to Varna on the Black Sea, the regimes planted by totalitarianism have more than 30 years to establish their legitimacy, but none, not one regime, has yet been able to risk free elections. And then in a wonderful line, regimes planted by bayonets do not take root. There he was paraphrasing, echoing Reagan's Churchill's Iron Curtain speech. But more importantly, he was arguing that it was ideas that would ultimately decide the Cold War. So I've laid out the ideological vision. What about the narrative? Reagan combined the ideological worldview with a narrative retelling of history that was driven by ordinary people wanting a say in their own lives, wanting a chance to build a better life, by wanting democracy. In a passage that Reagan wrote himself, he began this by saying, since the exodus from Egypt, historians have written of those who sacrificed and struggled for freedom, the stand at Thermopylae, the revolt of Spartacus, the storming of the Bastille, the Warsaw Uprising, World War II. And then he provided a little bit broader frame, talking about current events.
But beyond the trouble spots lies a deeper, more positive pattern. Around the world today, the democratic revolution is gathering new strength. In India, a critical test has been passed with the peaceful change of governing political parties. In Africa, Nigeria is moving into remarkable and unmistakable ways to build and strengthen its democratic institutions. In the Caribbean and Central America, 16 of 24 countries have freely elected governments. And in the United Nations, 8 of the 10 developing nations which have joined that body in the past 5 years are democracies. In the communist world as well, man's instinctive desire for freedom and self-determination surfaces again and again. To be sure, there are grim reminders of how brutally the police state attempts to snuff out this quest for self-rule. 1953 in East Germany, 1956 in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, 1981 in Poland. But the struggle continues in Poland, and we know that there are even those who strive and suffer for freedom within the confines of the Soviet Union itself. How we conduct ourselves here in the Western democracies will determine whether this trend continues. No, democracy is not a fragile flower. Still, it needs cultivating. If the rest of this century is to witness the gradual growth of freedom and democratic ideals, we must take actions to assist the campaign for democracy.
And then Reagan described what were relatively modest steps to promote democracy. As I said, it led to the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy. Why were they modest? Because Reagan wanted to support democracy everywhere that that could be done without risking war. And those steps did pay off, sometimes in unexpected ways. Reagan administration officials looked at their own foreign policy, George Shultz, who was Secretary of State, and decided that they were not living up to it in the Philippines and put pressure on the government of the Philippines to move toward democracy. The power of Reagan's narrative of gradual movement toward freedom and democracy in opposition to totalitarianism has been documented in the 40 years since the speech as democracy has spread around the world. Of course, there's backlighting. There are anti-democratic forces in the world. But Reagan's fundamental argument that totalitarian governments use force to keep their people from fleeing toward democratic governments is evident today. From Hong Kong to Taiwan to Ukraine to the Arab Spring, people all across the world in every possible culture and religion have demonstrated they want a say in their own governments, they want a say in their own lives, they don't want secret police. Reagan combined the narrative and the argument with a set of values. He contrasted freedom with totalitarianism and arbitrary arrest. He contrasted opportunity with economic decay. He contrasted democracy versus state control by unelected dictators. And he made it clear that when talking about those values, and the appeal to values is the dominant way one produces an emotional reaction, that he was not talking about Western values. He was talking about human values. He said, democracy already flourishes in countries with very different cultures and historical experience. He said, it would be cultural condescension or worse to say that any people prefer dictatorship to democracy. Who would voluntarily choose not to have the right to vote, decide to purchase government propaganda handouts instead of independent newspapers, prefer government to worker-controlled unions, opt for land to be owned by the state instead of those who till it, want government repression of religious liberty, a single political party instead of a free choice, a rigid cultural orthodoxy instead of democratic tolerance and diversity? Democracies have often not lived up to those values, but the power of those values is evident. Of course, no one would make the choices that Reagan outlined and choose totalitarianism. That's why Reagan was confident that the world was at a turning point. And I think now we can answer the puzzle. Why did Reagan's message work so much better in the long term than in the short term? First, Reagan's speech combined the three most important strategies for influencing people. When you give someone an argument, an argument that's a coherent worldview is an ideology that tells us how the world is now, how the world could be, and how to get from here to there. He gave us a worldview. Democracy works, totalitarian doesn't. He gave us a narrative, and an empowering narrative, not about a Western desire for freedom, but a human desire for freedom, tracing it back to Exodus from Egypt. And then he tapped into a set of values. And that's how one produces the emotional reaction. If you think about those three worldviews, the ideological worldview, the narrative worldview, the value-laden worldview as three Venn diagrams, you'd think those Venn diagrams just fit right on top of each other. They're entirely consistent, those circles. It's because the power of the message that it resonated so much in the long term. But there's a second reason it resonated so much in the long term. It resonated in the long term because what Reagan said turned out to be right. Reagan's arms buildup created pressure on the Soviet Union that eventually led to serious arms negotiations, that led to the two treaties I've mentioned. It turned out that Reagan really was for arms reduction. Early in his presidency, when Reagan said he was for real arms reductions, liberals thought that he was giving lip service to arms control, that he didn't really mean it. Many conservatives hoped he was just giving lip service to real arms reductions. But in fact, Reagan did mean it, and the two most important arms control agreements are negotiated during the Reagan administration. He was also right that the Soviet economy was crumbling. The Soviet Union looked at the arms buildup, and especially because they had a visionary leader in Mikhail Gorbachev, realized they couldn't keep up, and that's when serious arms negotiations were made. And Gorbachev himself said about Reagan that Reagan himself was there in the real hard times to carry forward the negotiations. And perhaps most importantly, because of the power of ideas, he was right that the people of Eastern Europe, the Warsaw Pact, that had been allied with the Soviet Union, that they wanted freedom and democracy. As soon as the Soviet Union began to end with the Berlin Wall coming down, there's a vast outpouring of people moving toward the free world. And soon the free world includes a united Germany, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, etc., because people did in fact desire that freedom. And those nations quickly applied for membership in the European Union, and as quickly as they could also NATO, because they wanted to protect that freedom. It turns out Reagan was totally right on those points. As is almost always true with Reagan, the narrative is the most eloquent, but the ideology was the most important. I now want to talk about some conclusions that can be drawn. And I want to begin with the stereotype of Reagan as a grade B movie actor, as old Hopalong. Remember that line I talked about today on the NATO line, and you can see it there. This is the draft of the speech written by Tony Dolan. The handwritten line there, that's Ronald Reagan's handwriting on it. He's the one who inserted that line. And then if you go to the next page, well, our technology, there, that's the page. Since the exodus from Egypt, that's all written by Reagan. I've traced in my book, Reagan at Westminster, written with my dear friend John Jones, I've traced almost every paragraph in this speech. Reagan wrote personally almost 15% of the speech, and he edited often quite heavily over 45% of the speech. Reagan was not a great actor. Maybe old Hopalong is not a bad way to describe him in Westerns. But he was a very sophisticated writer and editor. And I want to say something about the importance of academic objectivity at this point, the ideal of it. When I first started writing about Reagan more than 40 years ago, the press told me that he was been a bad actor, that he didn't know much, he was a mouthpiece, he was a threat to the world, and he was this radical anti-government conservative. And then I studied Reagan. And I studied Reagan, personally, I'm a lifelong liberal Democrat. But when I studied Reagan, that's not what I found. What I found, as in that editing page there, was that Reagan was a gifted writer and even a better editor. I found that he was actually not a warmonger, but very afraid of war. That he didn't put American forces in danger. I found that he genuinely believed in real arms reductions, and that's why he did a buildup to create leverage. That the funny thing about Reagan is he'd learned to negotiate by dealing with the studio chiefs in Hollywood when he was the president of the Screen Actors Guild. He later said, pretty good preparation for negotiating with the Soviet Union. I think he was right about that. And when I studied his domestic policy and read his rhetoric, I saw that Reagan was not simply anti-government, but he was for less government in this particular instance, in this present crisis, as he said in the first inaugural address. If I had not believed in academic objectivity, I would never have seen those things. A lot of people say objectivity is impossible. Postmodernists say that it's unimportant. I say it is an epistemic, a knowledge protection, because we can see when they're wrong, as I saw when I was wrong about Ronald Reagan. I want to make another point I want to make about this speech is that it's harsh words, and what Reagan said played a key role in the end of the Cold War. There's no question that this speech got the Soviets' attention. The New York Times reported that TASS stated that the president had, I'm quoting now, slandered the Soviet Union with crude anti-Sovietism and was supporting fascist regimes. Another Soviet newspaper, Izvestia, was equally harsh, labeling the speech a slander of the Soviet Union and arguing that the President Washington administration does not come to terms with reality, and it will not accept the principle of peaceful coexistence. The negative reaction of the Soviet newspapers tells us that Reagan succeeded in getting the attention of the Soviets. Richard Pipes, the National Security Council staff member I mentioned earlier, and a very significant Soviet scholar, told Reagan about the Soviet reaction, and Reagan's reaction was, "So we touched a nerve." He wanted to get their attention. The harsh words also cheered dissidents in the Soviet Union. Former Soviet dissident Natan Sharansky wrote of the impact of Reagan's words attacking the Soviet Union, "The dissidents were ecstatic. Finally, the leader of the free world had spoken the truth, a truth that burned inside the heart of each and every one of us." Think how Navalny might have reacted to a speech like this. The arms build up, The harsh words sent the message that the U.S. couldn't be bullied. Reagan consistently pushed for arms reduction, and that happened. It seems to me that the Westminster Address also speaks to us today. It tells us in the West, and not the West, the democratic world, how to confront totalitarianism. Defend democratic values. Speak up against totalitarianism and authoritarianism. To the United States, it says that we should support our allies, such as Ukraine, Taiwan, elsewhere in the world, but as Reagan was, be very careful to avoid direct confrontation. Be open to real diplomacy. As Reagan famously said himself, you don't need democratic agreements just with allies. It's your potential adversaries that you need to negotiate with. And I think finally, Reagan's words speak of the importance of nurturing democracy in our own country. At the end of the speech, the very end of the speech, Reagan wondered about the shyness of some in the West about standing for these democratic ideals that have done so much to ease the plight of man and the hardships of our imperfect world. He spoke of the bravery of the British people during the Second World War when this island was incandescent with courage. He told the story of a British woman whose house was bombed and during the Blitz in the Second World War, and when the people came to rescue her, they pulled out, they found a bottle of brandy underneath the stairs, which was all that was standing, and they poured some for her. And she wakes up and looks up and says, "Hey now, that's for emergencies." Reagan then said, "Well, the emergency is upon us." Reagan then spoke about the importance of protecting democracy. He said, "So let us ask ourselves, what kind of people do we think we are? And let us answer free people worthy of freedom and determined not only to remain so, but to help others gain their freedom as well." Then he references Churchill. "Sir Winston led his people to a great victory in war and then lost an election just as the fruits of victory were about to be enjoyed." And then, in words from the past to our present, Reagan said, "But he, Churchill, left office honorably, and as it turned out, temporarily, knowing that the liberty of his people was more important than the fate of any single leader. History recalls his greatness in ways no dictator will ever know. And he left us a message of hope for the future." Reagan knew that one of the key signs that democracies were working is that when you lose elections, you leave office. It seemed like a nothing phrase when he said it. It doesn't seem like nothing now. Reagan, like Churchill, left us a message of hope for the future. But even more important than his narrative was his argument that people want a say in their own government and a chance to build better lives. A blueprint for democracy promotion and keeping the peace. Thank you very much. And we've got some time for questions. And you shouldn't be shy. Oh, come on. And over there to the microphone. It won't bite.
I was just going to ask if you think the use of composite narrative was used throughout the piece of text.
It's a good question because you may be thinking Reagan doesn't tell a single story except in that passage, which he begins with the exodus from Egypt, but he tells a bunch of little stories. But if you think about it, those little stories fit together into a larger story. What is that story? Ordinary people want to build a better life for their family. Ordinary people want to not worry that the knock on the door is the secret police. Ordinary people want a free press. They want to be able to read stuff and have it not be lies. Ordinary people want a say in their own government. They want a chance to vote for people who can lead them. It's a pretty powerful narrative. And we've seen it all around the world. Think of the speed, the people trying to get from Hong Kong all the way to Taiwan in a little boat. What did Reagan say? That people never flee toward totalitarianism. And in the 40-some years since then, that's always been true, that ordinary people are fleeing toward a chance for a say in their own lives. I know some of you have questions, and you're not this shy normally.
So you mentioned some statistics about Reagan's approval rating in 82, and that many said he should not seek re-election. And then only a couple years later, he wins in the biggest landslide. So do you think that that is due to the things he's talking about here, the war on totalitarianism and the shrinking of government, or something else?
Reagan was always eloquent. But this, he won re-election mostly because the economy came back very, very strongly. But I hear an implicit question there about the relatively similar political situation that President Biden finds himself in at kind of a similar, a little bit later than when that speech was. And I think one thing you have to say is that if the economy continues to come roaring back, if the Reagan precedent is right, that should help Biden, but it hasn't helped him to the same degree that it helped Reagan. And it is no criticism of President Biden to say that he lacks President Reagan's level of eloquence, a level of eloquence that has only been matched by FDR and Obama and a few others, and only exceeded by King and Lincoln. So, and President Biden simply does not have that. That's not his fault, it's just the way it is. But in the long run, it's ideas that matter most. And Reagan's ideas resonated because they turned out, you know, the economy did come back.
You said critics were calling it during the time oversimplified, unrememberable, and that it was the average delivery. What do you think Reagan could have done to get his message across to the British Parliament a little bit better?
Well, I think Reagan got his message across, you know, a perfectly great way. This is what happens when you have very, very strong stereotypical worldviews. They knew that Reagan was just a movie actor. Right? It's just that that wasn't true. They knew that Reagan was a warmonger. It's just that that wasn't true. And so the problem was not with Reagan's words, it's that it went against what they thought was the case. And over time, it turned out that what Reagan said really was what he meant. And I understand why people thought those things. If you just read the newspaper, you would think these things. At the time, I remember very early in my period studying Reagan, I thought many of those things until suddenly I would run into things that I couldn't explain. If Reagan was such a grade B movie actor, how come in his debate with President Carter in 1980, he was so much better a debater than President Carter? And it occurred to me that, as I said already, Reagan really wasn't who we thought he was. He was a gifted political rhetorician leader, not a very good actor, but a really good political leader. He was well informed, especially about the Soviets, and had a coherent ideological worldview, and he had a very empowering narrative worldview. Those are the things that made Reagan so effective. In the short term, it was an impossible situation. In the long term, the message resonated.
You mention in this that one of the things that is pointed to is the idea that we should stand up for our allies, and you mentioned Ukraine as one of those. I'm wondering if more concretely the words of Reagan and what we see here offer a path for how people who are sort of pro-Ukraine, supporting Ukraine as that has become a thing of contention in U.S. politics, for at least the material support for Ukraine. Does this offer us some ideas for how one might make a pro-argument for doing that?
Well, I think if Reagan were here, that he would largely support what the Biden administration has done in with diplomacy and with military support, and he would definitely agree. But one thing they've done is that they've said to the Ukrainians, the material we send to you cannot be used to attack Russia directly. And that was Reagan's policy, essentially. Reagan wanted to build up. He wanted to support democracy and oppose the Soviet Union rhetorically, but he was extremely careful about putting U.S. forces into conflict in general, and especially with the Soviet Union, because he was well aware of the dangers of nuclear conflict. And in today's world, Vladimir Putin has threatened to use tactical nuclear weapons on a number of occasions. I think being extremely cautious is something that President Reagan would advise Republicans and Democrats. But he would also speak up for defending democratic values. And he would speak, I think, quite strongly to members of what of his political party about the importance of defending democracy and calling out Russian tyranny. In some ways, the situation is less stable today than it was then, because the Soviet Union at least had a collective leadership. There were some checks and balances within the Soviet Politburo. There is no collective leadership in Russia today. There's only Putin. And so I think that would suggest that Reagan's policy, but being extremely careful about putting U.S. forces in any way, anywhere close to direct conflict, that would be very wise. I think all Americans could read this speech today and draw insights about how we should be reacting to the totalitarians in our world.
How do you think his speculations that he made within his argument about like Russia's future and things that people of the British Parliament might not that have thought were true would have affected his argument and made it hard for him to convince people?
At the time, people thought the Soviet Union was going to be there forever. They thought it was naive. Reagan had seen economic data that demonstrated that the Soviet economy wasn't doing very well. He also fundamentally believed in the power of, well, democratic capitalism, not unregulated capitalism. That Reagan was on the conservative end of regulation. But he just thought that our economic system and our political system worked better than their systems. And there is a tendency among people like me, experts — I'm not an expert in those areas, I'm an expert in rhetoric and argumentation — to think that the world as it is will always remain that way. But Reagan was looking at something more fundamental. He was looking at what real human beings wanted. You know, real people want a chance to build a better life. They weren't getting that in the Soviet Union. Real people want to be able to say what they think and not worry about the knock on the door. Real people want media that tells them at least the truth a lot of the time. Real people want a say in their societies. That's why Reagan said, Democracy is not a fragile flower. Democracy is strong because that's what real people want. And what I've just said, that's true in the United States, that's true in Ukraine, that's true in Hong Kong, that's true in Taiwan, that's true in Moscow too. You know, as you saw all the people showing up to vote honoring Navalny. You see that all around the world, Africa, South America, obviously Australia, everywhere. I think Reagan would say the fundamentals support democracy because that's what real people want. I think if Reagan were here, he'd say that we need to cultivate democracy. But he'd be very optimistic about the future because he thinks he's talking about real people everywhere throughout human history. I'm very confident that he would be optimistic as long as we remember to stand up for freedom and democracy, to not give in to totalitarians anywhere. That the most important arms we have are sending messages that bombs and bullets are more about rhetoric than they are about actually fighting. That if we are strong, then that will produce both peace and a free democracy. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's Lectures in History podcast. To find even more history content, visit c-span.org/AHTV.